Thank you. I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober. I'm especially grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank Maurice and the committee for inviting me. I want to thank Sherry for picking me up at the airport. The thing she didn't tell you and she didn't tell me until we got from Salisbury here is that she doesn't see well in the dark. I don't know how many of you know Zippy. There's a noticeable calm in the room tonight. He isn't here. I'm not sure if he's been a wonderful host or if he's just diagnosed multiple personality disorder. But somebody really ought to monitor the amount of amphetamines he ingests. I've never seen anybody move quite as quickly as he does. But everybody here has been just really nice. It's been a really nice several days. I'm really grateful to be here. It's always interesting to me. I live in Southern California on the other ocean, and I come all the way across country, and there's three people here that I know. And that always just amazes me in Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor, who doesn't give me a lot of direction only because I ignore it when she does, has the only thing she's ever told me about talking in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, she said, there's just two things you need to tell them. Tell them your name and tell them the truth. I've told you my name. I'm not so sure I'm going to tell you the truth. I don't know about anybody in this room, but I didn't know that what it was like was going to be important. When I was out there practicing, which I think is a really strange word for what we do, I certainly never required much practice, but I got a lot of it. But when I was out there, I didn't know that I would be here tonight. When I was out there, I didn't know what it used to be like was going to be important, so I didn't pay a lot of attention to my life. If I would have known I was going to be here tonight, if I would have known it was going to be important, I certainly would have paid more attention. I'd have taken notes. There's some things that I did that I would not have done if I knew I was going to end up in Alcoholics Anonymous, expected to share with you what it was going to be like. The job that a lot of what I share with you was reported to me by other people, and I just simply have to believe they told me the truth. The job that I have, I had to get a fingerprint clearance, and I'm really good at fingerprinting. I fingerprint really well. And I was being fingerprinted, and I didn't want to raise any red flags. You know, I didn't want to make them curious. So as they were fingerprinting me, I very calmly said to the woman, how far back do you check? She looked me in the eye and she said, from the day you were born. Now, the book says more will be revealed. It doesn't say how. So when that report came back, the woman called me up and she had that tone. You know the tone that they have with alcoholics sometime? And she was very cautious when she told me my report had come back. And she said, you know, usually these reports are two or three pages long. She said, yours was 57 pages. Do you want to come see it? Well, of course I did. And I know more about my story now than I did before I saw that report. So what I'm going to share with you is my perspective of what it used to be like. It may or may not be the truth, but it's my perspective. I had my first drink of alcohol when I was 13 years old. I'm really sorry I waited that long. But I never had any idea what alcohol would do to me or for me. I don't remember ever thinking about alcohol one way or the other. I didn't think about, I couldn't wait until I was able to drink, and I didn't think I would never drink. I just never thought about alcohol one way or another. And yet when I was 13 years old, I was on a camping trip with a group of girls in Southern California. We were camped on the beach. And we got into the tent that night. I had a bottle of vodka in my pillowcase. And to this day, I don't know where it came from. I believe it was the grace of God, but I'm not sure. But I remember I pulled the bottle out of the pillowcase, and I asked if anybody wanted any, and they didn't. And the reason they gave me for not wanting it was all we had to mix with. It was grape soda and root beer. And I said, well, so what? And I took off the top, and I drank half the bottle, and I looked around, and nothing had gotten different, and nothing had changed. So I drank the second half of the bottle, and that was to be the end of my social drinking. Never again after that day did I ever offer anybody a drink out of my bottle. And I don't know about anybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I never had resentments until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of my early resentments in Alcoholics Anonymous is I heard you talk about your first drink. And I heard you talk about taking the drink, and you felt the warmth in your mouth. And you felt the warmth as it went down your throat, and somehow you felt it as it hit your stomach. And it hit your stomach and exploded. It went to your fingernails and your toenails, and your pimples fell off, and you grew a few inches, and you dropped a few pounds, and you became Prince Charles and Lady Di, and wonderful things happened to you. And that wasn't the case. I drank that bottle of vodka, and I sat in that tent, and absolutely nothing happened to me for about 15 minutes. And at the end of the 15 minutes, the only thing that happened to me was that I had to go to the bathroom. And it's my belief today that if you drink a quart of anything in about 15 minutes, you're going to have to go to the bathroom. And I got out of the tent, and I shuffled down the beach to the outhouse, and I went in and went to the bathroom. And when I got done and went to get up, I realized I was absolutely and totally 100% paralyzed to the toilet seat. I couldn't blink. I didn't feel my heart beating, and I was overcome with a sense of fear. And of course, the fear was that somebody else was going to have to come use that outhouse, and there I was, paralyzed to the toilet seat. Later in my drinking, I discovered that two people can use the same toilet at the same time. But the second person has to be very careful about what they're doing. But I didn't know that at 13, so I sat there and I had an intuitive thought. And somehow I knew that the body was made up of energy, and somehow I knew if I could gather that energy, I would be all right. So I guess it was my first formal meditation. I sat and I gathered my energy. And when my energy seemed to be all balled up, when it seemed to be all in one place, I just fell off the toilet, out the door, into the sand, and started crawling back to the tent. And of course, since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've discovered that my whole attitude that night was, my whole problem that night was my attitude. If my attitude would have been right, I could have had a fantasy. I was in the Marines, I was being dive bombed as I was trying to get back to safety. And if my attitude would have been right, it could have been a wonderful experience. In my own defense, I have to tell you, my pants were still down at my ankles. I had started to get sick, and I couldn't quite get through it, and I couldn't get around it. And I think under those circumstances, it's a little difficult to have a good attitude. I did manage to get back to the tent. I fell in, and I passed out. And when I came to in the morning, I realized nobody was in the tent with me, and I couldn't figure out where they went until my eyes cleared enough that I realized I'd been sick all night long. I'd hit the top of the tent, the side of the tent, the floor of the tent, and quite frankly, I don't want to be in there either, so I got out of the tent. And that was my first drink of alcohol, and it was the most fabulous, magnificent, wonderful, marvelous spiritual experience I'd ever had. And it must have been because I put some amount of alcohol into my body on a daily basis from that day until the day I came to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't always get drunk, and I didn't always drink the kinds of things that you would classify as a beverage. I drank a lot of vanilla extract. I used to buy it by the six-pack. I drank a lot of mouthwash. I drank perfume. Taboo became my after-dinner drink of choice. I still have a problem. If you're wearing it, I may follow you too closely and just start lapping at your neck. I'm often tempted when I talk to introduce myself and say, "I'm Patty, I'm a pig." Because I ate, drank, shot, shoved, rammed, crammed, everything. I'm the person who went to your house and ate and drank everything in your bathroom. And I don't know that my life's any different than anybody else's. I don't know that my life's any different than anyone else's. I became a bar drinker. I was a living room drinker, a bedroom drinker, a car drinker, an alley drinker, an office drinker, a dumpster drinker. I didn't specialize. I just drank. But I love bars. I love sleazy bars. I'm sure you don't have any in Ocean City, but I like the really sleazy bars with the sawdust on the floor and the mirrors are cracked and the upholstery around the bar is ripped, where people have tried to hold on as they're falling off their seat, and they're full of smoke and they have that wonderful used booze urine smell. I salivate still when I think of it. But you know what fascinates me in Alcoholics Anonymous? I am fascinated in retrospect when I think about the quality of people who drank in those bars. There were CEOs of big companies. There were bank presidents. There were neurosurgeons. There were admirals in the Air Force. I mean, that's what they said they were. And we're in those places drinking, and we're not having conversations. Nobody's looking at one another saying, well, what do you prefer, the red mouthwash or the green? Well, what's your preference, Chantilly or Aqua Velva? We weren't having those kinds of conversations. So I don't know that my life's any different than anybody else's. I don't know that other people don't drink like I do. I think I drink because I want to drink. I don't know that I don't have a choice. I don't know that at 13 years old I put alcohol into an alcoholic body and from that day on I have no choice. I think I drink because I want to drink. I had an opportunity to go to college. I graduated from college with a 3.8 grade point average, and I only share that with you because it almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because see, when I got here, I thought I was too smart to be an alcoholic. Nobody with a 3.8 grade point average could possibly be an alcoholic. Chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic, drinking on a daily basis. I graduated from college with a 3.8 grade point average, and I stayed and took classes for a master's degree because I'm the kind of person, I'm doing something good, I want to keep doing it. And I figure I'd do school well, so I stayed and took classes for a master's degree. And I left college and had an opportunity. I'd been offered a job. I went to San Diego State in Southern California. I was offered a job in Chico, which is north of the other end of California. I loaded up everything I owned into my car. I took two cases of beer, two bottles of booze, and I headed north. I got 66 miles north of San Diego to Santa Ana. I was out of booze and I was thirsty. I pulled off the freeway. I have a sense I could find the sleaziest bar in town without even looking for it. I pulled into the parking lot of this place. I walked in. It was full of smoke. Willie Nelson was singing on the jukebox, and I knew I was home. I sat down. I ordered a drink, and that's as far north as I ever got. 66 miles from where I started from. Alcohol controlled every area of my life, and I don't know it. I think I drink because I want to drink. I don't know that I don't have a choice. I got a job in the profession of my choice. I rose very quickly to the top, and that too almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I came here, I told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I told you about the trophies and the plaques. I told you about the big oak desk that I sat behind. What I didn't tell you about was the days that I would come to wrapped around the leg of that desk, 5 o'clock in the morning, the cleaning lady coming in, and I don't know anybody but an Al-Anon who enjoys the sound of a vacuum cleaner. But but she's coming in, and I'm telling her I don't need my office clean today. I like it this way. And I know there's a bottle in that desk drawer, and if I can just get a hit off of that bottle, I'm going to be okay. And I was in the newspaper business, and I didn't tell you about the times that I would come to out of a blackout at a podium, much like this, in a room full of people, holding an award, not knowing if I was giving it or receiving it. And so I would say thank you, and I would go sit down, and then somebody would elbow me and tell me I was presenting it to the Junior Women's League, and I'd have to get up and start over again. And I didn't tell you about that. I just told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of drunk driving assault. Another resentment I had in Alcoholics Anonymous, I discovered you can get arrested for a single charge of drunk driving. I never knew that. I always got arrested for drunk driving assault. And it had something to do with how I got out of the car. And I do field sobriety tests well. I'm the kind of person, I get released from jail, I get the arrest report, I read it, I find out where I made my mistake so that next time I'll get that part right. And I always knew there'd be a next time. I always knew there'd be a next time. So I had practiced field sobriety tests a lot. I was really good at it. And on the last one, I was doing a really good job. I'd have given myself an A+. I was doing an excellent job. And at the end, the officer asked me to say the ABCs backwards. Well, the time before I had responded with, well, I can't even do that sober. And then I just confessed, and they cuffed me and took me in. So on the last one, when he asked me to say the ABCs backwards, I said, okay, and I turned around. See, you think it's funny. The sheriff in Orange County has absolutely no sense of humor. They knew me. They hadn't had a sense of humor in a long time. I had a reputation as a violent drunk, only I don't know it. I remember one time I left the office, and I only went to the bar because that's what you did if you were in the newspaper business, because that's where the leads were. That's where the breaks were. That's where you got, and I got a lot of leads. The problem was I wrote them down on those stupid little napkins, and they'd get wet, and the ink would run, and I'd have to go back the next night, because, you know, that's what you had to do, and it's the only reason I went there night after night after night after night. But this one night I left the bar and I was headed home, and it hadn't been a good news night, I guess. And as I turned left onto my street, my power steering went out of my car. And as I turned left, I slammed into a car parked on the left-hand side of the street. And I panicked, and I turned the wheel just a little bit to get in the middle of the street, and I slammed into a car on the right. And I turned a little to the left, and I slammed into one on the left, and one on the right, and one on the left, and I finally pulled into my driveway, and I sat there so relieved that I had gotten home safely. And I sat there for a few moments of gratitude, and I finally got out of the car, and I went into the house. I'm in the house for maybe a minute or two, and the doorbell rings. I look at my watch. It's 20 after 2. Who is visiting me now? And I go open the door, and it's the Orange County Sheriff, the guy with no sense of humor. He wants me to come out in the front yard. I'm trying to tell him about my car. He is not mechanical. He doesn't care about my car. He's pointing down the street. And I said, yeah, and ain't it grand? I got home safe. And he opened up the back of his car, and I have a reputation as a violent drunk. I got in the car, and he shackled my ankles. And he cuffed my hands behind my back, and we started going for a ride. I don't have time to go for a ride. I have to get some sleep. I have to go to work in the morning. I don't know where we're going. We're going for a ride. And in California, the policemen have little metal fences between the front seat and the back seat. I never knew why. I don't know who they're protecting, but pretty soon we're on the freeway and the devil flew in me. And I don't know if the devil ever flew into you, but the devil flew into me that night, and I honked up a big one, and I just spit right on the back of his head. And he didn't take too kindly to it. He sped up. And he started going really fast. And when the speedometer hit 100 miles an hour, he slammed on the brakes. And my ankles are shackled, my hands are cuffed behind my back, and I can't break the fall. And I went face forward into that metal grate. And that night, they're taking my mugshot. They kept calling me Waffle Face, because I had the... And that's how it was, day after day after day. And I don't know I'm a chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic. I think I drink because I want to drink. I don't know that I don't have a choice. 26 years old with 12 drunk driving assaults. And the other thing that, I don't know if it was a good thing or a bad thing, but I drank during a time where you could pay an attorney $1,000 and they'd get you out. They'd go to court. You didn't even have to go to court. They'd go to court for you. Call you up, tell you what the deal was. You do the deal, and that was the end of it. And one time, though, my attorney was nervous because I had 2 drunk driving assaults pending at the same time, and he got nervous, and I figure if your attorney's nervous, you ought to get nervous, so I got nervous, and I was sitting in a bar worrying about this deal one night, and struck up a conversation with the guy next to me, and he worked in a mortuary, and I came up with a plan, and I think alcoholics, we come up with really good plans, and this was one of my best. We went over to the mortuary, and we got a death certificate, and we put my name on it, and we filled out all the information, we forged a doctor's signature, and we sent it to the court. Because the judge can't expect you to show up if you're dead. And I called my attorney the next day, and I told him he didn't need to worry about it. We didn't worry about it for about a month. And then I got arrested for drunk driving assault. And I remember that time the judge wanted to see me. And I went into court that morning, he looked at me and he said, "Miss Ochoa, tell me, how is it a dead person is standing in my court?" I shrugged my shoulders and I said, "I don't know, bad luck." And that's what I thought it was. I thought it was bad luck. I thought it was bad breaks. I thought it was the cops. I thought it was you and they and them. It was my boss. It was circumstances and conditions. It was a lot of things. It never occurred to me it had anything to do with alcohol. Never occurred to me. And so at 26 years old, standing in court that morning with the public defender, because the day of the $1,000 attorneys were gone, Because of my past record, I was being sentenced to 10 years in prison. And in the middle of sentencing me, the expression on the judge's face changed, the tone of his voice got different, and I know he was as surprised at what he was saying as I was at what I was hearing. Because in the middle of it, he looked at me and he said, "I know this won't work for you, but I'm going to offer you one more chance," and he offered me an alternative. And part of that alternative was meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I stood there for 5 minutes trying to make a decision. Been to jail, know how to do jail. There's more alcohol and other drugs inside the institution than there are some days on the street. If you know what to do, who to do it to, and you're willing to go to any lengths, and I always was. And I stood there, and the public defender's putting his elbow in my ribs, and I'm trying to decide, 10 years or the alternative? Which is the better deal? And I finally took the alternative. I wish I could tell you that I left the courtroom. I came here. I looked at the 12 steps. I knew they were the solution to the problems in my life. I worked them all in the first week and skyrocketed to recovery. But that's not my story. I drank for 3 more months. In retrospect, I can tell you that I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known. I didn't drink a greater quantity. Physically, it would have been impossible to drink a greater quantity of alcohol. But I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known. And on October 4th, 1975, the day before I was to go back to court to tell the judge what I was doing with the alternative he gave me, on that day I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a Sunday night. It was a speaker meeting, and I can't tell you who spoke that night, but I heard 2 things. I heard, "We don't drink between meetings." I looked around, and I didn't see any of you drinking during the meeting. And I thought, if you're not drinking in the meeting and you don't drink between the meetings, when do you drink? This made me really nervous. The other thing I heard was that the answers were in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So after the meeting, I stole the book. I mean, God knows I need to have the answers. I can't tell you how irritated I was when I got home. Not only could I not find the answers in that book, I couldn't even find the questions. And I thought, oh dear God, I've stolen the wrong book. I'm going to have to go back and get the right one. And I'm a thief. I don't know I'm a thief, but I'm a thief. My sponsor has to tell me I'm a thief. I think it's important to have a sponsor. I think it's really important to have a sponsor who's not as emotionally involved in your life as you are. Mine isn't. It irritates me most of the time, but her perspective of my life is just a little different than mine. She has to tell me I'm a thief. I don't know I'm a thief. I'm drinking in a bar. The bar closes. I pick up some keys off the bar. I go find the car that they fit. I drive it home. My sponsor and the San Diego police think this is Grand Theft Auto. I think it's alternative transportation. So I have a record as a thief. It is humiliating for a thief to have stolen the wrong book. I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous to get the answer book. I don't think it matters what brings you back. I think what's important is that you come back. 4 days later, I came to my second meeting to get the answer book, and that was a small discussion meeting. And in that meeting, I heard, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. And I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I could not figure out what it was you had that was so hot that I should be willing to go to any length to get it. Some of you had nice jewelry. If you stood next to me during the Lord's Prayer, if your rings were loose, they were mine. Some of you have nice cars. I'm a car thief. I know how to get those. Some of you have nice spouses. We all know how to get those. I could not figure out what it was you had, and then I saw him. And I truly believe there's a him for each of us. This guy was a skinny little fellow. He was bald-headed. He wore baggy pants, and they weren't in style then. I don't know what it's like here, but in California, they wear pants these kids that I work with have pants that they could put 3 of their closest friends in their pants with them. They're like huge. I keep telling them, if this building ever burns down, you'll get out, but your pants won't. This guy had on baggy pants, but they weren't quite that baggy. He had on tennis shoes with no shoelaces, but the holes were there where they should have been. And he nodded out during the meeting. And I thought, if I have to do this thing and not drink, I want to do it his way. So I found out where he worked, and the next day I snuck down to his office and I said, "Dick, I have to do this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to stay out of jail, and I don't know how to do it." And he told me if I would go to meetings and read the book, and talk to other alcoholics and not drink. He said, I guarantee you, you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And I'm grateful he told it to me that way. He didn't tell me my life would get better. He didn't tell me my finances would get better, my relationships would get better, my family life would get better, my job life would get better, my sex life would get better. He didn't tell me any of it would get better, and I'm grateful, because none of it has. It's a little hope for the newcomer. But it's all gotten different. And as I stand here tonight, I can tell you from the top of my head to the tip of my toes, I have never had it so good. See, all I wanted out of this deal was to stay out of jail. That's all I wanted. If I'd had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. I don't know good from bad for me. I'm going through something I think is good for me, and it generally turns out to be bad for me. I'm going through something I think is bad for me, and it generally turns out to be good for me. And I don't know good from bad for me. I've gone through times in my recovery where my entire life has fallen apart. I've gone through times in recovery where everything I've worked for has been taken away from me. I've gone through times where I've lost jobs, I've lost relationships. It seems to me that God brings me this far and then takes off to help one of you. And just has abandoned me. And I didn't drink and I didn't die, and I have always gotten far enough beyond that to, in retrospect, see that when I think it's falling apart, what's really happening is it's falling together. And it has to be exactly that way for God to move me to where he'd have me be. So I don't know good from bad for me, but I know different. And every area of my life is different than the day I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have never had it so good. If I'd have had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. If ever a single day in the last 20 years I'd have had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. There's a God who has a plan for me beyond my wildest imagination, and I have a pretty wild imagination. And I believe that old man, and I don't know why I believed him. I hadn't believed a human being in a very long time, but I believed him. I left there, I already had the book, so every night I'd open it to chapter 3, and I'd read the line that says, most of us are unwilling to admit we are real alcoholics. I'd say amen and close the book, and that was reading the book. My court program said I had to go to 2 meetings a week. I thought that was really obsessive, but I was willing to go to any lengths to stay out of jail, so I went to the 2 meetings a week that my court program said I had to go to. I'd go down to the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach where they have AA meetings. I'd have a cup of coffee on the way out. I'd say hi, Jim, to the manager. He'd say hi, Patty. And that was talking to another alcoholic. And the only thing I did right is I didn't drink. And I didn't drink, and I didn't drink, and I didn't drink. And I was not the kind of newcomer that you embraced. I've heard people say you loved me until I could love myself, and I think that's nice. I wouldn't let you love me. You tolerated me, though, and I'm grateful for that. You see, it seems to me that I was hurt all of my life. It seems to me that all of my life people hurt me, they disappointed me, they let me down. And so as a small child, I began to build a wall to keep you out. And the wall worked really well. It was a really big wall, and it kept you out. What I didn't know about that wall is it made me a prisoner inside. I lived behind that wall in isolation and loneliness, and I didn't have a clue. But I wouldn't let you get close enough to love me. The only thing I knew when I came here was anger, and I acted it out in rage. Somebody would come up to me after a meeting. I'd take a swing at him. I'd kick at him. I'd spit at him. I'd throw my coffee at him. I'd throw coffee pots. I'd throw a chair at a guy one night, went through a plate glass window. One night a guy was sharing. He irritated me, didn't say anything to me. Just I took it personally. And after the meeting, I jumped him. I was beating his head into the concrete floor. And took 6 guys to get me off of him, and when they did, one of those men looked at me and he said, Patty, he said, next time that volcano goes off, he said, just put your hands in your pockets and don't touch another human being. And I wondered how he knew about the volcano. Nobody had ever talked to me about the volcano before, but that's what was inside of me. I had a volcano inside of me, and when it erupted, I had to do something. When it erupted, I wanted to see blood, preferably yours. And Alex told me just to put my hands in my pockets and not to touch another human being. And I walked around Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time with my hands in my pockets before I discovered that that anger was a cover for a tremendous amount of fear. I was absolutely scared to death. I was afraid of you. I was afraid of life. I was afraid of me. And I had survived in places where you can't survive if you're afraid. And so I had begun to cover that fear with anger and acted it out in violence. And it took me a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous to discover that. But people weren't rushing up to me after a while, and pretty soon the only people coming up to me, it was if your sponsor was irritated with you, your sponsor would point to me and say, see that woman over there? Go give her your phone number. And so being a good AA, you'd write down your phone number and you'd come over to give me, and I'd go off on you. But you tolerated me, and nobody ever told me I had to leave. I would stand up in the speaker meeting in the back of the room, and I would tell the speaker what I thought of him. It would usually be profanities, but I stuck them together so well that it sounded like a sentence, and I would spew it out from the back of the room, and somebody sitting in front of me, usually a little blue-haired lady, would smile and say, keep coming back. And I'd flip her off, and I'd wave my court card in her face, and I'd tell her I didn't have a choice, and I'd sit down until I went off again, and you tolerated me, and you tolerated me, and you tolerated me, and I am eternally grateful that the people in Alcoholics Anonymous understood the traditions when I walked in. I remember one night I heard the traditions read. We read them at every meeting in California, but I hadn't heard them up until this one night. And the third tradition, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I was so excited, I jumped out of my chair. I said, that's it. I don't want to stop drinking. I want to drink more than I want to breathe. I don't want to stop drinking. And I headed for the door, and an old-timer grabbed me, and thank God for the old-timers. This guy grabbed a hold of me, and he said, Patty, said there's a judge in South Orange County Court. He has a desire for you to stop drinking. And in your case, we're going to let that be enough. I don't think it matters whose desire you're here on. I don't think it matters what your motive for being here is. I think what the key is don't take a drink. I think the key is don't take a drink. And I didn't take a drink, and I didn't take a drink, and I didn't take a drink. And 8.5 months away from my last drink, the pain of not taking a drink and not recovering was so unbearable that it drove me to my knees. The pain of not drinking and not recovering drove me to my knees, and on my knees, I saw the evidence of my alcoholism. You all saw it when I walked in. But 8 months without taking a drink, I got far enough away from my last drink to see the evidence of my alcoholism. And on my knees that night, I took the first step, and I understood the powerlessness. I understood that alcohol had become my mother, my father, my God, my lover, my friend, my companion, my support, and at some point it had turned. I believe it was in the middle of my first drink, but at some point it turned and began to strip me of self-esteem, self-worth, dignity, integrity, honesty, pride, all the things we have going for us as human beings. And by the time I got here, it had taken it all. I was powerless. Whenever I get into the ring with alcohol, I lose. Whenever I do battle with alcohol, I lose, whether I'm fighting it because I'm drinking it or I'm fighting it because you're drinking it. I have a disease that manifests itself in denial, justification, and rationalization. And whenever I do battle with that disease, I lose. I have a son is a direct result of my alcoholism. I never wanted to be a mother. I found out that is not adequate birth control. But my son was 11 months old when I got sober, and I brought him to Alcoholics Anonymous with me, and he grew up here. You raised him. You taught him how to love. You taught him how to be kind. Everything he knows, he learned from you. I couldn't teach him. I didn't know it. You also taught him how to con and manipulate, but I guess you have to take the good with the bad. When my son started high school, I guess is when it started, I had people telling me things like the teachers at his school telling me that they thought my son might be smoking some marijuana, his grades were slipping. I said, oh, no, he can't. He's grown up in Alcoholics Anonymous. Can't possibly be happening. He's probably just one of those kids that just doesn't do well in school. He'll do well, you know, in his early 20s. It'll become important to him. And I had friends telling me that they thought my son might be using some drugs, and I said, oh, no, it can't possibly. My disease will justify, whether it's for me or if it's for you. My roommate found a bag of marijuana in his bedroom, and out of my mouth came the words, oh, he's probably holding it for a friend. And one night, and God will do for me what I can't do for myself. God won't do for me what I can do for myself. I keep waiting for God to send me money. I can go to work. God will not send me any money. But God will do for me what I can't do for myself. One Friday night, right before he was 18, my son came home about midnight, 12:30, and the bags are now about to his knees. I think it's because we're close to the ocean. The boy never went in the salt water, but it must have been something about the ocean. And he came in this one Friday night, and I looked at him, and out of my mouth came words that I would never have said to my son. Out of my mouth come the words, are you loaded? And he had heard me say it over and over and over and over about him. He said, "No, I'm just tired." And I said, "Well, if you're tired, you need to come home before 12 o'clock at night. And you have to make a choice. You can either smoke dope or you can live in my house, but you can't do both." I would have never said those words to my son. I'm a single parent. I have always been a single parent. I would have never said those words to him. And he went into his bedroom, and 10 minutes later, he came out with a backpack over his shoulder, and he had made a choice. Intellectually understand that choice. I have made that choice over and over and over and over. Intellectually understand that I have given up everything for one more drink. The only thing I wanted to do since I was in the fourth grade was be a writer, and I had an opportunity to go into that business, and I gave it up for one more drink. Everything in my life I've given up for one more drink, and intellectually understood his choice. But as a mother, it broke my heart as he walked out of my house. And I was 16 years sober, and I have never been in that kind of pain. And I sat on my couch trying to decide if I should drink or kill myself, because nothing else would relieve that pain. And I sat on my couch trying to make that decision. And I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, if I don't take an action, nothing happens. So I sat on my couch, and I thought about what I should do. And I sat there for 2 days, and on the second day, a woman that I sponsor called me, and you know how they are. They never say, "How are you doing?" I answer the phone, and she starts right in talking about him, and I have heard about him for months, and he did this, and he did that, and he quack, 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 quack. And I said, "Listen, it's noon. I'll meet you at the Canyon Club for the 12:30 meeting. We'll go to the meeting, and then we'll talk about him." I met her at the meeting. We went to the meeting, and then we talked about him, and I want to tell you what that did for me. It didn't eliminate the pain. It did not eliminate the pain, but it took just enough of it away so that I wasn't immobilized on my couch. It took just a little bit of it away so that I didn't have to sit on my couch and try and decide what to do. And in that meeting, when we said the Lord's Prayer, I got a little courage on one side and a little strength on the other side to give me what I needed to choose to take the right actions another day and another day and another day and another day. And I don't know if my son has a problem. He never moved back home. He did live in his van in my driveway for a while. That's about as close as he got. But we have a different kind of relationship today. We're building a new kind of relationship. I don't ask him questions I don't want to know the answer to. And I don't know if he has a problem, but I know he knows where you are. We are all God's children. And I know he knows where you are. But that's my powerlessness. Whether I'm fighting it because I'm drinking it, whether it's denial, justification, and rationalization for me, or whether I'm rationalizing and justifying it for you, I'm powerless. And my life had become unmanageable. Alcohol controlled every area of my life. Alcohol controlled where I would live, where I would work, the people I would run with, and eventually the people I would run from, and I didn't have a choice. I was damned to live the same way day after day after day after day, and I had no choice. I want to talk for a little bit about the steps, because for me, that's what happened. What happened, what it was like, I believe we all have exactly the same story. We just acted it out a little bit differently. What happened for me is the 12 steps of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, because there is no way to get from where I was on October 4th, 1975, to where I am tonight, except through the power and the magic of the 12 steps of recovery. And I don't know if I'm having a hot flash up here, or if it's really just hot, but if it's a hot flash, I want y'all to know you're at the very beginning of my menopause. And this is just my experience. If you have a different experience with the steps, it's your experience. This is my experience. For me, step two says, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. For me, sanity is how I think. My thinking is just a little skewed from the rest of the world. My thinking is just a little different. My next door neighbors are not alcoholics. And I know they're not alcoholics because they've never come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. They're married to each other. They have been married to each other forever. Neither one of them has ever been afraid to come home. Have you ever been afraid to come? I was afraid to come home and I lived by myself. The two of them opened one beer, one of those little, I call them shooter beers, those little ones. They open a beer. And the one who's not holding the beer doesn't seem to care that they're not holding the beer. And then one of them will take a drink out of the beer, and the one who's not drinking it isn't monitoring how much the one who is drinking is drinking. And then nobody's holding the beer. And the beer just sits there unattended for minutes. Seems like days go by with the beer is unattended. And then one of them will say to the other, honey, where's the beer? Honey doesn't know where the beer is. I know where the beer is. And I live next door, but I know where the beer is. My thinking is just a little skewed from the rest of the world. And I came to believe that a power greater than myself would restore my thinking. Every once in a while I hear us tell a newcomer, don't think. I don't know how you do that. I think all the time. I'm talking to you, I'm thinking about something else. Then I start thinking about the fact that I'm thinking. Then I start thinking that I shouldn't be thinking what I'm thinking while I'm thinking what I shouldn't be thinking. Then I try not to think about what I'm thinking. And I'll tell you what, I'm grateful I don't have a speaker on my head so that everything I thought came barreling out. That would be truly humiliating, but I came to believe that this power was going to restore my thinking. And for me, the power greater than myself. I'm a loner by nature. Left to my own devices, I prefer to sit on the couch. I have one social skill. I used it today about 9:30, fresh out for the day. I'm a loner by nature. I love things like fishing. I love throwing and reeling. I don't like to catch much because then you have to touch the fish and they're really kind of smelly. But I like throwing and reeling and throwing. And I like to I enjoy my own company a lot. I'm tempted to write a book, Women Who Love Themselves Too Much. I don't have a problem with God. Well, I do. I have one problem with God. I believe we're all God's children and I have always wanted to be an only child. But I have no other problem with God. But for me, the power greater than myself is not God. Because if you're a loner, I would have sat on my couch. God would have flown by, sprinkled me with sanity, taken off to wherever it is God hangs out, and that would have been the end of it. I would have never had to do another. I'd be on my couch tonight. So for me, the power greater than myself was the action of steps 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I came to believe that through taking the action, the steps, I would be restored to right thinking. Chuck used to say it. I couldn't think my way into right living, but I was able to act my way into right thinking through taking the action and the steps. And the steps for me were the power greater than myself. Step 3, I hear people talking about having trouble with step 3. And you tell them, ask them, what step are you on? They go, I'm on the third step. You know, every morning I get up and I turn my will and my life over the care of God, but about noon I take it back. Well, I'm working on the third step. You know, I'm turning my will and my life over to the care of God. Everything except for my sex life and my finances, because I don't want to be poor and celibate. And, you know, I hear those people, and I really stay about as far away from them as possible, because I don't think they understand the step. I was out driving by myself yesterday, and I was coming down the road out here to come to the meeting, and I was coming up to Convention Center Road, and I had to make a decision. Go straight, turn right, or I don't think you can turn left, but... And I made a decision to turn right because that's what I had to do to get in here, and I went straight by the convention center. And I made a U-turn, and I'm coming back, and I'm coming back this way, and I got to make a decision, turn left or go straight. I made a decision to turn left because that's what I got to do to get in here, and I went straight by the convention center again. So I made another U-turn, I'm going back again, I got to make a decision, go straight or turn right, and make a decision to turn right, and I did this with the steering wheel. And I made a right-hand turn into the convention center. The decision that I made had no impact. I'd still be going back and forth on that street if I had never taken an action. The decision in step 3 had no impact on my life until I took an action. And of course, the action that I had to take was step 4. And I thought step 4 was fabulous for those of you who weren't writers. I'm a trained writer. I don't need to do this inventory. It's for those of you who need to brush up on your creative writing skills. You need to do it. But I don't, and I didn't, and I didn't, and I didn't, and I didn't, and I didn't. And then something happened to me. I came to a meeting one night in pain. I sat in the middle of you and felt unique. I felt isolated. I felt alone. I knew there was no sense sharing because you weren't going to understand anyway, and I left in more pain than I came in with. And I came back the next night in pain. I sat in the middle of you, and I felt unique. I felt different. I felt isolated. I knew there was no sense sharing. You weren't going to understand anyway, and I left in more pain than I came in with. And I did that night after night after night. Until the pain of being with you was so great that I knew I had to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't stay here in the kind of pain that I was in. And on my way out that night, I had one of my thoughts. And the thought was, before you leave Alcoholics Anonymous, why don't you try writing a 4-step? So I went home and I did my four step the way the book says to do it. I found the little diagram, which is the only part that breaks from text, which really irritates me. I think they'd have a picture or two in there, but I found the little diagram and I wrote down in the first column who I resented, which basically turned out to be everybody who breathed air that I thought should have been mine. They ended up on that list. And then what they did to me, well, I've wanted to tell you all my life what they did to me. I was really having a good time doing it. I was sorry I waited this long. And then I wrote in the third column how it affected me. Well, it affected my security, my sex life. Well, no wonder I drank. If all these people did all these things to you, you'd drink too. And in my zealousness, I accidentally turned the page of the big book. And two pages after the diagram, hidden in the body of the text, it says, referring to our list again, we put out of our minds the wrongs others had done. Well, now it wasn't any fun anymore. But I did that. I made that column and I wrote down what my part is. I did that with my resentments, my fears, and my relationships. And when I got done for the first time, I got a look at who Patio really was. He said, I spent my whole life putting on a show for the woman who has lost her last wingnut. I need to tell you that the things I have always thought were my greatest liabilities in Alcoholics Anonymous become my greatest strengths. And the things I thought were my greatest strengths here become my greatest weaknesses. An example, I'm a strong woman. I've always been a very strong woman. I learned very early to do it myself. If I couldn't do it, it didn't need to get done. I didn't need you or they or them. Whenever I have tried to do anything by myself, I've shortchanged myself. And that strength has become a liability in Alcoholics Anonymous. Whenever I try to do anything by myself, I shortchange myself. And that's true in every area of my life. I went home from doing my fifth step, and I did step six and seven by mistake. I didn't mean to recover this quickly, but I just by coincidence opened the big book to where it talks about step six and seven. And the big book is really poorly written. Any newcomer will tell you that, but that part about step six and seven gets kind of poetic. And I just kind of got lulled into reading it, and I just kind of was reading it. And when I became aware of what I was reading, I was in the middle of the seven-step prayer. And when I became aware of what I was reading, I knew that I believed it. And I finished reading that prayer, and the thing that it says in the book happened to me. I walked through the archway to freedom. I walked away from the person I had been all of my life to start to become the person God intended for me to be. And I believe that's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. The miracle here is we have an opportunity to walk away from the person we've been all of our life to start to become the person God intended for us to be. And I'm afraid too many people leave before the miracle happens. The best I've ever described myself when I came here was an animal with latent human tendencies. That's what walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the steps work and because you've been willing to share with me, I've become very kind, very loving, very gentle, very nurturing, very caring. Of course, now they're telling me it's codependency and I have to recover from it, but and it doesn't mean my character defects were zapped into the universe. I mean, they're not free-floating. You don't need to worry about any of them falling on you. My character defects were the tools that kept me alive long enough to get to you. And I got them with me all the time. I pull them around in my little red wagon. And don't you be taking any. I pull them around with me all the time. And you see, I somehow thought if I work the steps hard enough, I'll be beyond my humanness. If I am diligent enough, I will be beyond human feeling. What I've discovered is working the steps that brought me into my humanness. And as a human being, sometimes I get afraid. As a human being, sometimes I feel inadequate, sometimes I feel not enough, I have human feelings. The good news is that I come here, and you give me the courage and strength so that those feelings don't immobilize me. You share your experience with me so that I know I can go through it without having to take a drink. But sometimes you're not around. Sometimes I get afraid and you're not around, and I pick up a defect and I use it. And when I don't like the way it feels, not when you don't like the way it looks, but when I don't like the way it feels, I just ask God to remove it, and he puts it back in my wagon. I was, not because of me, but because of my job, when I had to give a lecture on spirituality one time, and I left my house late. Now, I'm the kind of person, I leave late, I think if I drive fast enough, I can get there on time. So I left late, and I was driving fast, and I was driving really fast, and I got to a traffic jam in a place where there shouldn't have been a traffic jam. I slammed on my brakes, we moved a little, we stopped. We moved a little, we stopped. Now I'm already anxious because I'm late. We move, we stop. The guy behind me lays on his horn. Now, I don't know where he thought I was going to go other than the car in front of me. And we move, we stop, he honks. We move, we stop, he honks. I'm already anxious because I'm late. We move, we stop, he honks. I'd had it. I put my car in gear, put the brake on my dress-up clothes and high heels. I get out of my car and I head for his. He had electric windows. He almost got them rolled up. He missed by about this much. Just enough for me to get my little arm in there. I got him by the collar. I twisted it and I pulled his little face to the window. I started telling him about his mother. I told him to do things that I really think are physically impossible, but the veins in my neck were sticking up. I mean, I was letting this guy have it, and I'm sure he didn't like the way it looked long before I didn't like the way it felt. But as I was letting him have it, I took a breath, and in that breath, I realized I picked that rage up from my wagon, and God had removed that rage a long time before that, and I didn't like the way it felt. Now, I wish I could tell you I let him go, but I didn't. I did loosen up, though, so the blood ran back into his face, and I apologized for how I behaved. I told him I believed every word I said to him, but I let him go. He got his window up that fast. I got my car. We moved. We stopped. He didn't honk. We moved. We stopped. The traffic finally cleared, and I got to where I was going, and I gave one of the best lectures on spirituality I have ever given. And the reason I was able to do it is because the steps work. The reason I was able to do it is because I asked God to remove the defect. I didn't have to run that tape that says, you're a lousy member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're really no damn good. You've been fooling all these people all this time. Quack, 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 quack. I didn't have to run that tape to beat me up, and I didn't have to stop and take a drink. You see, if I don't take a drink, I have a chance to do it different next time. If I take a drink, I have no choices. If I take a drink, I have to live the same way day after day after day after day, and I have no choice. If I don't take a drink, I have a choice to do it different next time. Nobody's honked at me since, so I don't know if I'll do it different. But I have a choice, because the steps work. And I didn't have to beat myself up. Steps 8 and 9 for me are conventional ways of getting rid of conventional guilt. I felt guilty because I was guilty. I did a lot of things to a lot of people for one more drink. I felt guilty because I was guilty. My sponsor, who is a real pain in the ass, nag woman, just, I had a lot of unfinished business. I'm a really fast starter. I start about 120 miles an hour, but then I kind of get tired. And so I had a lot of stuff that I started, but I hadn't quite finished. And she wanted me to clean up these loose ends. She wanted me to finish up this unfinished business. And one of the things that really she got her teeth into was my master's degree. I had taken all the classes, but in my field I had to take 2-day oral exams, and I just didn't do it. And she wanted me to finish it. I don't want to finish it. I've dragged myself out of my profession of choice. To this day, I can't work in that field in Orange County. I don't want this stupid degree. They're going to make me take classes. It's too much. And she's like nagging at me. So to shut her up, which is the reason I do anything, I call San Diego State, and I explain. This woman answers the phone. I explain to her. I want to tell her about my sponsor, but I didn't. I just told her I needed to find out what I needed to do to finish this degree. She puts me on hold. She comes back on the phone. She says, well, our records indicate that you have a master's degree. I said, no, you don't understand. I never finished it. Now, I don't even want this stupid thing, but then I got obsessed with it. I'm calling all over. I finally get a hold of the guy who was the head of my master's committee. I explained my problem to him. He said, Patty, you have a master's degree. I said, but I had to take 2-day oral exams. He said, you did. And with that alcoholic arrogance, I said, well, how did I do? And he said, you were brilliant. I said, well, of course. And I hung up. And I have friends who want me to call around. I might have a PhD somewhere. And what's really funny, the people I work for like letters after your name. So I look at my business cards. You know, I have these letters after my name. And I laugh because I know where they came. Well, I don't know where they came from. You know, I mean, it's. But I cleaned up I got right with you. In 8 and 9, I got right with you. And in getting right with you, I got right with God. And I had never been right with God before. In getting right with God, I got right with me. You see, it had never been enough. It had never been the right kind. I needed that job, that house, that relationship, that car. And I get that stuff because we're good getters. But then it wasn't the right car, it wasn't the right job, it wasn't the right relationship. And when I'm the kind of person that can use a year's supply of anything in a week. When I got right with you and got right with God and got right with me in step 9, for the first time in my life, it was enough. It was exactly the right kind. Now, that doesn't mean I don't want more. I'm a pig. I want what I have, but I look in your eyes and I see there's so much more available and I want it all. I don't want to shortchange myself, and that's what brings me back day after day to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I want it all. Steps 10, 11, and 12, I hear people talk about maintenance steps. I don't know what they're maintaining. I was even, which is nice, but 10, 11, and 12 for me are the growth steps. They're the steps that allow me to continue to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I look at them kind of like that escalator out there. You know, I went down and I was coming back up and there was like 20 bazillion people waiting to get up. So I went to the down escalator. Now you can get from the first floor to the second floor on the down escalator, but you got to keep moving. And that's what 10, 11, and 12 are. They keep me moving up the down escalator. If I stop using them, I don't hit bottom right away, but I start going down. If I don't start using them pretty quick, eventually I'm right back to where I was when I started. So they keep me moving up the down escalator. 10 says the process is powerful. Keep using it. Keep writing about it, talking about it. Ask God to remove the defect, make amends when necessary, and then turn your attention to someone you can help. What is it I can do for you? How can I be of service to you? Step 11, I'm a simple person. My prayer in the morning is very simply, thy will be done. And I'm so naive that I truly believe the rest of the day is God's business. My job is to not take a drink and to live life to the fullest. I happen to be a formal meditator, but my best meditation comes in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is where I get my answers. Left to my own devices, I don't know how to live out there. I learn how to live by coming to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Every once in a while I hear somebody say, take what you need and leave the rest. I don't know what I need. If I knew what I needed, I wouldn't have come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I need it all. I have taken it all. Everything I have heard in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've used. And maybe I won't use it today, maybe I won't use it tomorrow. But next month, next year, 5 years from now, everything I have heard in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, when you have shared your experience, strength, and hope with me, I have used out there. You see, I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to learn how to live. I only came here to stay out of jail. That's all I wanted out of this deal. And I have gotten so much more. Step 12 is the greatest gift you've ever given me, the opportunity to give a little bit of my dark past, a little bit of that despair, a little bit of that alcoholic, incomprehensible demoralization to another human being and say, honey, you don't ever have to live that way again a day at a time. A day at a time, take our hand and walk with us and you never have to live that way again. I have done everything wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous. I need to tell you that because sometimes I hear my story and I think, oh, really, they should be calling me Saint Patio. I have done everything wrong. I'm very judgmental. I love taking your inventory and I break my neck to share it with somebody else. I've slept with newcomers and I'd do it again in a minute if I had a chance. I mean, think about it. We tell them they're the most important person in the room and then we ignore them for a year, you know? I've charged for 12-step calls. My mother lives in a different town than I do. Thank you, Jesus. And I was visiting my mother, and when I visit my mother, I go to AA meetings. If you visited my mother, you would go to AA meetings. But so I know a lot of people in the area where my mother lives, and one Sunday I was visiting, and the phone rang, and it was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she was just hoping I would be there because she had gotten a 12-step call. And you know, the door swings both ways, and you're always welcome back. But sometimes if you go and come and go and come and go and come, pretty soon people get tired. People, you know, and what I know it is for me is it's my fear because I see it happening to you and I know it can happen to me. And this woman had called Alcoholics Anonymous, come and gone and come and gone. And she called that day and this woman got the call, but she couldn't get anybody to go with her. Everybody had gone in 12-stepped her. Everybody had talked to her. Everybody had done what they could do and nobody could go. And so she called my mother's house in hopes that I would be there, and I was. And I went on the 12-step call with her, and this woman, this drunken woman, had more money than I would ever. I mean, she had an oak door that was 3 feet. I mean, a big old oak door. It took us a quarter of a tank of gas just to get up her driveway. If money could keep you sober, this woman would not have had a problem. And we got up there, we went in, and she came down the spiral staircase in a nightgown that had wine and puke on it. And she came spiraling down, and I sent the other woman into the kitchen to make coffee, and this woman gets to the bottom step, and I looked at her, and I said, you know what, I know why you can't stay sober, and it's not your fault. You can't stay sober because the people in this town won't tell you the secret to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I live in a different county, so I can't just give you the secret, but for $100... Now, I should have asked for more. She pulled $100 out of her pocket without blinking an eye and handed it to me, and I put it in my pocket, and I looked her in the eye, and I said, the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous is if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And about then, the other woman came out, and I looked at her and said, well, we don't have to be here anymore, and we left. And when that lady took a cake for 1 year of sobriety, I gave her back her $100. And never once during that day... Never once during that time did she ever tell anybody I charged her $100 for that 12-step call. And she's 14 years sober, a very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and has not taken a drink since that day. And my experience is it doesn't matter what we say to one another. My experience is that if I let God work through me, if I truly believe in the morning when I say thy will be done, I don't think we can say anything wrong to one another. My life today is better than my wildest imagination. I have a job that I really, really love, that I'm really, really good at, in a field that I would never have considered working in. God tricked me into it. I wear a beeper, and I used to wear my garage door opener so that I looked important, but now I have to. I have a relationship with my son that's healthy. I have people in my life that love me, and I love them. And that big wall that was between me and you, that big brick wall, the night I did my fifth step, that wall didn't fall down. One brick came out of that wall. And every time I've shared with another alcoholic, another brick has come out of the wall. Till tonight, I have no wall between me and you. Oh, I have a little styrofoam thing I throw up once in a while, because sometimes I get afraid. And then the person on the other side, just poof, and it's gone. And I can let you love me, and I can love you. And you know what? People hurt us. You know what? People disappoint us. You know what? Sometimes people aren't there for us. But my experience is that that doesn't immobilize me. That doesn't paralyze me. And that doesn't kill me. I come here. And it takes a lot of courage and a lot of strength to continue to choose to recover, and I don't have it. So I come here. And the person on this side will give me a little courage, and this person will give me a little strength. And you give me the courage and strength that I need to walk through the times that I'm hurt, and the times that I'm afraid, and the times that I feel inadequate, and the times that I just don't think I can make it another day. You give me the courage and strength that I need in order to continue to choose to recover. I'm going to tell you a story, and then I'm going to shut up, because I got on high heels, and they are killing my feet. It's the story of the man that goes to see St. Peter, and he asks St. Peter to show him heaven and hell. St. Peter takes him to a room, and it says hell on the outside, and they open the door, and they look in, and they look in at this banquet, tables and tables and tables of food. Any kind of food you could think of, as much food as you could imagine. They even had low-fat food there. All kinds of food, and the people in that room were starving. They were dying, and they were hungry. And the reason that they were hungry is they had those long wooden cooking spoons tied to their hands. And the spoon was just a little bit too long, and they couldn't quite get the food to their mouth. And so they sat amongst plenty, and they were starving. And that's how I was before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was out there amongst plenty, and I was dying. And then he took them to another room and said, heaven. They opened up that room, and it was the same banquet. Tables and tables and tables of food, as much food as you could ever imagine, any kind of food you'd ever want. And the people in that room had those long wooden spoons tied to their hands, too, and the spoons were just a little bit too long. They couldn't quite get the food to their mouth. But the people in that room were full, and they were happy, and they were content. And the reason was is that one man was taking a spoonful of food, and he was feeding the man across the table. And the man across the table was feeding the person next to him, and she was feeding somebody else. And that's how Alcoholics Anonymous works for me. I don't have my own answers. I have to come here, and I have to let you feed me. And every once in a while, if I'm lucky, I get to give a spoonful of this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to somebody else. And you don't have to have a year, 5 years, or 10 years. If you've got one day, You have something to feed to the man or woman walking through the door. If you have one day, you can take the hand of the new person and look them in the eye and say, honey, you don't have to live that way day at a time. Take my hand and walk with us, and you never have to live that way again. When I was 4 days sober, an old man told me if I didn't drink, I wouldn't get drunk. And if I didn't get drunk, my life would get different, and he didn't lie to me. And I always end with the same thing, and I end with it because it's been my experience. And I pray, God, that it's your experience. And it's a line in chapter 5 that says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Thank you.